Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And I should probably say happy Labor Day or happy Labor Day afternoon. We're going to be talking about a number of topics today. Later in the show, I'm going to have some things to say about the further about the melodrama of the American departure from Afghanistan. But we'd like to focus in the first half, at least, on the Labor Day, labor movement. And our guest is Tony Lea, who is a labor militant and also a scholar of labor history. Tony, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Phil.
So why don't we, Mark, say one thing right off the top. Around the world, as far as I know, Labor Day is not marked on September, you know, the first week, whatever it is, first whatever September, but is usually treated as May Day, 1st of May is internationally. So do you have an idea about why we don't do celebrate May Day?
I do. I think that it's because some of the militant traditions of the working class movement have been dampened down and covered up by the powers that be, and they've tried to suppress the history of the struggles that led to May Day originally being a working class holiday, and it's still recognized around the world. But a lot of people identify it with other parts of the world and don't remember that it started in Chicago when workers across the United States were striking for an 8-hour day, and police attacked and killed some of the strikers in Chicago. And then there was a huge rally where some bombs were thrown, whether by provocateurs or somebody else, was still unclear, but it was used as an excuse to round up socialist and militant working class leaders, and several of them were hung for their crimes of fighting for the working class. And that then became recognized internationally as a day to celebrate workers' struggles. And in much of North America now, that memory has been suppressed. And the replacement is, you know, the less militant festival atmosphere of having a march to celebrate Labor Day when that's little bit more acceptable.
It's interesting. I think they were, was it the 8 or the 10-hour day? What was it they
were? Well, workers were working 10 or 12 hours a day, but that was a strike to establish the 8-hour day. It wasn't successful until later, but that was a strike for the 8-hour day.
And the year was, what was that?
1886.
And do we have the 8-hour day? Don't you and I, if I remember rightly, we're on this show, we're talking about a union which waged a major battle in the United States, it concluded only about a month ago, and they didn't achieve an 8-hour day. I mean, what was it, a 72 hour?
Yes,
week?
They were able to reduce their maximum weekly hours from 84 to 72.
So we are
just 6 12 hour days.
Oh my goodness. I mean, there is this kind of, they were always kind of being told, well, we've got this far and we owe it to those guys 100 years ago. And you say, yeah, except we don't have what, we didn't make it. You go back and look, and the issues are practically the same.
Well, there's been tremendous progress made at times, and then workers get beaten back. And, you know, we have to be honest, as long as the other class holds political power, gains are going to tend to be temporary, because they'll find a way to beat us over the head and try to take them away again when we're, you know, if we don't keep our eyes on the prize, as they say.
Yeah. One thing, because of COVID, we're not having the gathering at down at the park. The good part of it for me is that at least Labor doesn't have to show up there at 11 in the morning to get a free ticket to go in and have warplanes flying over them all day.
Great.
So that's progress. What is Labor doing?
There's a variety of things that are happening. We're in Oshawa, where my home local is. There's only an online event on Zoom. The Toronto Labor Council is holding a cavalcade, which sounds, you know, like it should be some fun. And if it's successful, I think it'll get some attention and be a way of getting labor's demands out in the public eye. And in Hamilton, where the steelworkers in Local 1005 have quite a strong history, there's still a Labor Day march happening.
Is even with these conditions, I can't recall, did they do it last year, or what do they do? They had social distancing and that kind of thing, or they use cars? What do they do?
I'm not sure about last year, but they definitely are marching this year. Of course, people are asked to observe all of the proper health and safety protocols and wear masks and be distanced, but they are going to be marching in the streets of Hamilton. Which I think is an important step.
Yeah. We have now had a dramatic. We've had a change in leaders. The Canadian Labour Congress, Hassan Youssef, who was from the Union Unifor originally, and he became the president of the Canadian Labour Congress. And over the years, there's great unhappiness with his inability to do anything other than put flowers at the feet of the prime minister or to brag to members that he could occasionally meet the prime minister on their behalf. He's now in the Senate. The day he left office, he joined the Canadian Senate, which is not an elective office. I doubt that anybody would have voted for him from the union movement. So are you seeing any, what's your sense of the new leadership?
I think it's early days for the new leadership of the Canadian Labour Congress. I'm hopeful about the people who were elected. Brusque is the new president. I think it's noteworthy that her and three quarters of the top officers are women, and I think that hopefully they'll bring a fresher perspective and be more in tune with rank and file workers and the needs of rank and file workers. I think we've seen a bit of that with Patty Coates as president of the Ontario Federation of Labour, for example. So there are some hopeful signs, but I think that there's clearly a long way to go before the labor movement is fighting in a more forthright way for the interests of our class as workers and not getting tied into political games, particularly with the Liberals. And that's become, a serious impediment to the labor movement in this country.
I guess one of the striking things that came up at the Labor Congress, and you told us about it, but I'd like actually you to repeat the story, is that a resolution came from the floor, I believe, saying that they should reassociate or associate openly with the New Democratic Party, which has the label social democracy. It's the party of Jack Layton and David Lewis and others who, a couple of those people called themselves socialists, I think. Tommy Douglas did. If anybody remembers his name, he contemporary of George Washington, I guess. Anyhow, the outgoing president tried to suppress that decision, right?
I can't remember all of the ridiculous maneuverings that he tried to impose, but he tried to declare the motion out of order on some pretext when clearly the political views of workers in this country should be one of the foremost things that the Canadian Labour Congress takes positions on. And he was defeated on that. He was challenged on that and defeated, which I think was certainly a positive sign. And it goes along with more clearer, stronger endorsements of the Palestinian cause by the Canadian Labour Congress and by a growing number of unions, which is another good indication that there's some, people are seeing better the needs of workers in this country having to be allied with workers around the world, and that sense of international solidarity and common cause against the people who are oppressing all of us. That's really where we have to go.
Mm-hmm. By the way, that I'm really glad you raised that point, because the very painfully and it's quite embarrassing actually that the New Democrats and the Green Party have been doing their best to try to keep the issue of the Palestinians particularly off the agenda. But if Labour is going to begin to get much more engaged, that issue is going to come in via them as well as it's not just going to be, you know, this writing or that, because the Labour movement has been stronger and stronger on that, on this subject. So
while we don't seem to have political parties that are prepared to support issues like the Palestinians, sadly. So the labor movement can be a really positive role in forcing those issues to be discussed.
And but I don't suppose, as you say, they've only been in office, what, I guess about 4 months, four or five months, the CLC leaders. So it's, I don't know, I'd be interested, I don't know if you know, that if they're beginning now with this current campaign to speak up or to play a role, the kind of role that they had not, they've been prevented from playing all the time of Hassan Youssef's leadership.
And I would like to see that. I'm probably not close enough to it to know everything that's being that's going on or being said. I was looking at the Canadian Labour Congress website, and their election material seems to be predominantly exposing or attacking the Conservatives and O'Toole. And there's no doubt that needs to be done. He's no friend of workers, and he's trying to portray himself that way and trying to use that as a way of, you know, gaining support. But Justin Trudeau is no friend of the working class either. And he's been quick a number of times to outlaw strikes, cozy up to corporations of all kinds, particularly oil companies and pipelines. And, his class and our class in on the same side.
Your union, Unifor, did something rather striking, and one assumes it's associated with the election. They posted, I don't know if it's still up, but a clip of Doug Ford talking about billionaires and how mean they are or wrong to want to take industry out of Ontario. Were you impressed with that? You at General Motors, you have some memory about some of the billionaires who move plants.
It is a pretty weird story, Phil. The workers at De Havilland Aircraft are fighting for their jobs because the, as happens more and more these days, they, the company was sold to another company that wants to move it. The property's been sold. And so the issue is, are the jobs going to stay in this community, in the Toronto community, where the workers could carry on, or are they going to move to somewhere else or another province? And that really is exactly the same issue that we faced in Oshawa when GM said that they were going to end vehicle production a couple of years ago, and 5,000 jobs were going to disappear. And Doug Ford's first comment then, immediate comment, was he had talked to General Motors and they were leaving, and that ship had left the dock. And so there was nothing he could do. This time, I guess he has decided to try to gain some political brownie points by saying that, you know, he wants the company to keep the jobs in Ontario. And they got lots of government money, the same way that GM did, of course. And so they shouldn't take the jobs and leave. And knowing his history and, you know, the backers for that party and who they represent, you have to be pretty skeptical about whether he's going to deliver anything. But the leadership of Unifor, you know, just were falling all over themselves to praise Doug Ford for making this statement and putting, you know, a clip of his speech on their Facebook and Twitter and web page. It sure looks odd, you know. It looks odd to workers who know that there's something fishy going on there and that Doug Ford's not on our side. You know, some people will remember that that Jerry Dias a few years ago made a financial donation to a woman who was running for leadership of the Conservative Party, Kelly Leach, you know, a rather unsavory political person. She was associated with the, what was it called? Barbaric Cultural Practices Hotline or some weird thing, racist attempt to stir people up. And his rationale, like, he didn't brag about it initially, but when it came to light that he donated money to her, he said, well, he was in her riding and she was a friend of his.
Hey, oh man.
And then, you know, and then they just hoped it would all go away. But, you know, now they're promoting Doug Ford you know, in between lining up to support the Liberals and Justin Trudeau, whenever they can.
It has another element to it in that the backdrop being that the Tories trying to present themselves as friends of Labour at this moment, Mr. O'Toole has had several little, I would call them gimmicky ideas of put a Labour representative on the board of directors, which has been widely, for those who took it up and said, shall we talk about this seriously? They point out that there is precedent. And in Europe, when they say put Labour on the board of directors, they mean 30% of the board. They're not playing around.
Yeah, in some cases, 50%.
Yeah. Remember Mr. Fraser of the United Auto Workers, it was a huge deal that he got named part of a big battle. He got named to a member of the board. And they boasted of that achievement. When he passed away, UAW said, okay, we're sending now so-and-so. And was it General Motors said to him, said to them, no, that was a one-off. That was for him. That was for Fraser. Not.
Yeah, no, it was a personal deal. And it's that kind of tokenism for a labor leader who is chosen basically or approved by management to sit on their board and rub shoulders with them is not giving greater voice to workers. It's a sign of corruption.
No, that's like putting him in the Senate.
It's like putting Hassan Youssef in the Senate. Doesn't benefit workers. It's a payoff for a labor leader who has sold out workers and done what the company wants. And it's particularly, I think, relevant when we look at the UAW and their history with the big auto companies, that starting with Fraser and you know, him being on the board of Chrysler, we've seen a progressive decline into that union being tied up totally with defending the interests of the corporation and trying to tell workers that their interests were the same and that they had to cooperate and they were all a team. And then we saw that lead to the kind of corruption that, you know, is always associated with the worst influence of gangsters in unions. But in the case of the UAW, it wasn't gangsters, it was the corporations that were funneling money in.
Yeah, I want to mention there that isn't it interesting? I mean, the Ruthers, let me put it this way, the Ruthers are dead. And I know you regard them as overrated in the first place, at least Walter, but they did have a reputation for hygiene. They were considered a clean union, would be compared, for example, to the Teamsters, which kind of bragged about not being clean. That was sort of their calling card is, well, we may be corrupt, but we get things done. And I mean that. Jimmy Hoffa, I used to talk to Teamsters who said to me, I don't care about his ponies and his horses as long as I get a good contract. But Ruther and his group were always talking about honesty and democracy. And so now you have a story to tell. They really got busted up for serious criminality. Tell about that.
Yeah, it started with a couple of cases coming to light. They were being investigated by the feds in the U.S. And then it got broader and broader. And it eventually there were 12 top officials of the UAW who were indicted and are serving time in jail
the top guys.
12 top leaders, including two former presidents, were indicted. And convicted, they pleaded guilty. They all pled. And along with representatives of the corporation, Chrysler Corporation, people will remember some of the catchphrases. The one Chrysler rep said that in his pleading that the intent of the scheme and the reason that Chrysler was willing to funnel lots of money to these people, union reps, was to skid the grease the skids for concessions, and so that the company could get the kind of collective agreement or concessions in the collective agreement that they wanted. The other Chrysler rep said that the goal of this policies was because they wanted the union reps to be fat, dumb, and happy. and they were pretty successful at it. If you look at the collective agreements where the auto industry used to be in the forefront for workers in winning wages and vacations and significant improvements. They now are leading the way in concessions and two-tier agreements and the elimination of pensions from workers. And that has been happening in Canada as well. So I don't want people to think that, that the bad UAW is doing it and we're doing better here in Canada. We're not. We're following the same path. And we also have leaders who, try to tell workers in Canada that, we got to be do the things that the company wants and make sure the government gives them money so that we can keep jobs here. And it's the exact opposite of the tradition of the labor movement of fighting, using your strength as workers in order to win gains. The good thing about what's happened in the UAW is that where the corruption became so evident that it led to charges, that really inflamed the membership. And there's a growing, strong rank and file movement in the UAW pushing for greater democracy and more militancy and to get the union back on track fighting for the members. There's a new group that calls themselves Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD. And one of the things that they advocated as a response to all of this corruption was that the members of the union, all of the rank and file members, should have a direct vote for the top leadership, the president and the executive board, instead of having them elected by delegates at a convention. And the consent agreement that the UAW leadership signed with U.S. Prosecutor includes a provision that in a couple of months, all of the members of the UAW are going to get a referendum vote on whether they want to move to direct elections and one member, one vote. And as part of this rank and file movement and the people who are pushing for that, I think that it's a very significant development.
Oh, absolutely. If you get one member, one vote, it means you have to appeal to all those members. You have to say what you're going to do, and you have to answer their questions. You're not talking to delegates, you're talking to members. And if you actually have the trust of those members, then you actually have some power, because this delegate system, it becomes just a coterie of leaders, and the members are alienated from the process. But if you have to engage with them, you got to convince them, then you have a living union that can be led. You can say, look, I told you what I was going to do. You voted for me. We're going to do this. The other system is people say, I never go to the meetings. I don't care. I don't, you know, it's a brass. The brass decides. No, it's going to be very exciting. When is that vote, by the way?
They haven't set the date yet. It's going to be done by mail, I believe. So it'll take place over a period of time. I think that people are going to get their ballots in October and that they'll have till some date in November to return them. But I don't think it's been finalized yet.
It's a very powerful story. I think everybody should follow that closely. Could you say the name of that, the rank and file movement that is going to try to replace?
Yes, they are leading the fight for one member, one vote. It's called Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD.
Yeah. We're speaking to Tony Leo. This is CIUT, the Taylor Report. Tony is a labor activist, a member of the Unifor, and a labor scholar. And there's a new novel out, Baraka Books. It's called The Maker, and pardon me, Maker, no, The Maker, by Jim Upton. You know, we don't have working class novels very much, Tony. So I'm curious, you read it. What do you think of it?
It's a terrific novel. And you're right, we haven't had enough labor novels. There's a tremendous tradition of labor novels in the past as being associated with the labor movement. When the UAW was being organized, one of the novels that was used to help organizing was The Flivver King by Upton Sinclair, which was published by the UAW in the mid-1930s and helped the organizing effort. And of course, a lot of people with socialist traditions or roots know about the ragged trousered philanthropists and the role that played in building the labor movement and the socialist movement in the UK. And I think that the Maker by the new novelist, Jim Upton, is in that tradition. It talks about the lives of the workers. So it centers on a union and the struggles of the union, but it's based on their working life, what happens to them at work. The woman who becomes a leader of the union first leads a fight in her department against overtime. The company is using overtime to avoid recalling people who are laid off. And she said, that's not right. And she convinces her fellow workers to start refusing the overtime. And after a few weeks, the company is grinds to a halt because they need more work being done, and they give in and they recall the laid off workers, and that propels her to becoming a union rep and then later president of the local and ends up leading a strike against the kind of concessions and attempt by the company to take away pensions that we've been talking about. That's such an important issue for the labor movement everywhere these days. So I think it's a really important publication.
Is this novel, is Maker based on a real story? I mean, did this occur, and what union, and where was it?
No, it's a fictional company and a fictional union, But it has a lot of resonance with the very heroic strike by workers at United Aircraft in Quebec in 1974, 1975. The maker is set just in the past decade. And in fact, but it's also in an aerospace company. And in fact, one of the veterans in the union local that the president talks to and learns from turns out to be a veteran from the United Aircraft strike. So there is that resonance there. Another nice detail that I liked about the novel is that it's set at the time when the Quebec students were fighting against tuition hikes, and it didn't get enough coverage in the rest of the country, but it was a huge uprising in Quebec, started by students, which eventually had tremendous support from workers and the labor movement. They shut down all of the schools and colleges and universities. They were marching in the streets and banging pots and pans, and everybody was wearing red squares. And that's mentioned in the novel. And, it's this solidarity between the young people, the students, and their parents who are workers is mentioned in the novel. And I think it was a nice touch.
I noticed the author, as is described his background, is he worked for 25 years in unionized jobs at an aerospace plant. during this time, he was active in several sets of contract negotiations, including one as a member of the Union Bargaining Committee. He lives in Montreal. That's Jim Upton. This is quite a remarkable thing. This is his first book, isn't it?
I believe it is, yes.
And you found it very readable.
It's very readable, yes. I highly recommend it.
How about an idea? We should approach, urge people. You mentioned the United Auto Workers, when they were first forming, asked Upton Sinclair to write a book about the auto business and Henry Ford. And it was called The Flivver King. I knew about the Flivver King. I did not realize that the union asked him to do it. And of course, they used that book for organizing purposes. So why can't we get the union movement to begin to circulate a novel like this, like The Maker by Jim Upton?
It's a great idea.
Do you know if unions are even sort of told? I don't know if he's approached them, but there's a scarcity of working class literature, and it actually for practically a century, it was a tradition to have working class literature, stories about the down and outs, the stories about guys trying to form union, stories about struggles amongst unions. It was all very helpful because a lot of people with like Jim Upton's experience knew what they were talking about. They could really give you a quick education and how difficult it is to have a union, how difficult it is to get any progress. And I think the people ought to approach the Canadian Labor Congress leadership and say, pick 5 or 6 books a year that you say to all members, get this book. Which brings me to this book. I'm glad I talked to myself about this. Ed Asner, a name I want to talk to you about. He has passed on. He was a union leader. He led the Actors Guild. And he had been an auto worker, by the way. He even remembers what his job was, shining something. He said he used to, I guess it was a fender. But anyhow, the title of his book is The Grouchy Historian. An old-time lefty defends our Constitution against right-wing hypocrites and nut jobs. That's Ed Asner, 2017. And Tony, you took a close interest in a great battle, which was not a victory, and was marked almost a turning point of the further decline of North American labor when Ronnie Reagan, a handsome boy from Hollywood, decided to destroy the air controllers And Ed Asner was right in the thick of that battle. Can you talk about that, what that was?
The air traffic controller strike, of course, was a huge event because the workers knew that they had a considerable amount of leverage and power because their jobs were really essential. And but they had a funny history because they had endorsed Reagan in the presidential election, so they thought they had a bit of an in there, and they were prepared to use it. And they had really awful conditions, right? They're under tremendous stress in that job, and they wanted to improve their working conditions and improve their pay. And they decided that if they were prepared to go on strike, that they could tie up the air industry in the U.S. and win some things. And they did go on strike, and they did shut everything down. It was incredible. But they weren't expecting, I don't think, Ronald Reagan to say, that he obviously didn't care that they had supported him. That was fine, but he wasn't going to allow labor to exercise power to that degree in the United States. And he gave them, I think, 24 hours to return to work or they would all be fired. And he followed through on it. And he fired every single air traffic controller and made sure that none of them would ever work in the industry again. And that lasted for probably 15 or 20 years. And he stuck it out. The aircraft companies themselves wanted to negotiate at an end because they wanted people back to work. And he just told them no.
People, by the way, real controllers.
He said no matter how much it cost. A year later, the aircraft industry in the United States was operating at 50% capacity, they took huge losses. But Reagan was determined to break that union and to show his power to the labor movement in the United States. And the labor movement in the United States did not rise to that challenge and take him on. And
I'm glad you raised that, by the way, because that's when people, unfortunately, don't know the old political slogan that, don't keep book. Because they raised with the air controllers differences that they had with the other members of the labor movement, which was not the time to start talking like that.
No, it's it's not. But the air traffic controllers, I think the leadership of that union has to bear at least a little bit of the responsibility that they also were pretty diffident about having ties with other unions. And with people in the community, they thought they could do it on their own. And they also didn't recognize the need to fight against discrimination against women or to support Black workers in their industry, both of whom were underrepresented because of sexism and racism. And as a result, they didn't support those people. Those workers formed their own caucuses within the union, and they were lukewarm about supporting the strike because they hadn't been supported by the leadership. So there's a lot of lessons to that, but you're right. The fundamental lesson is when the labor movement as a whole is being challenged like that, you either respond or you take a licking. And Ed Asner did step up and he did march on the picket line with those workers after they'd been fired. And he said, this is the kind of fight that we need to take as actors. And this was when he was running for leadership of the Screen Actors Guild and then got elected after that. He had real principle. And in terms of, referring back to a point that we talked about already, which is understanding the connection between the interests of workers here and international issues and workers around the world, I found a nice quote from Ed Asner I wanted to read. Because he was also a very forthright supporter of workers in South America, Latin America, who were being attacked by U.S. Imperialism and by Reagan. Not a lot of people in the labor movement did that. And he challenged that at a convention of the AFL-CIO And this is part of what he said. It does not make me proud to see us bolstering the foreign policies of those whose stated goals include the destruction of our own labor movement, he said on the convention floor, referring to Reagan. I love the labor movement and the things it stands for. It makes me more of a human being. That's why I'm here. It's because I love the labor movement that I don't want to see it sullied by any foreign policy that belies our highest ideals.
That's a great quote.
It's a good quote.
You know what? That was the murder of the Catholic nuns in El Salvador, in which American officials almost openly boasted about their involvement in it. The fascists in El Salvador took them out, cruelly killed these women. And that again was, I believe it was the Reagan administration. And Asner did the right thing. And it's great that he was being supported. He was a popular leader. However, and people like, we tend to think about the struggle, about the repression of American labor movement and repression of American freedoms. The term is always McCarthyism, and that's 50s. But this happened in the 80s, 70s, 80s. And he was, of course, a victim, if you want to use the word. I think the word sometimes is, because it's almost wrong to use it. The repression is continual. And authoritarianism from the American capitalist class, Ed Asner was a victim. He had one of the most popular television shows, Lou Grant, and they shut him down. They told him, nope, it's over. And they, of course, they said, oh, it doesn't have anything to do with his politics. Oh yeah, sure. He knows when he lost work. We make these references to other countries where people lose jobs because of their political positions. He himself said, by the way, he got into acting in the 50s when he had kept his mouth shut, he said, because McCarthyism was repressing. But eventually, you know, there began to be a wider socialist movement and he came to the fore. He kind of arrived with the Cuba business, the Vietnam, and the struggle against racism, civil rights movement, and people found their voices. But when you don't hear the voices, it's not because they're not there, it's because somebody says, I'll fire you. And the power is in the hands of the monopolist. They decide. And Asner is just a wonderful figure. And people should go and see his old interviews, the things he tells about, he had a big fight with the other side of that Reagan show, which was John Wayne was actually said in an interview with Playboy magazine that he believed in white supremacy. He had it's interpreted his run-ins with Ed Asner, he was anti-Semitic. Asner, actually, his life, again, labor movement ought to have a look at him, because once he's an actor, you don't think of him as a labor leader, even when he is, but he's the head of a guild. The guild has done many heroic things over the years. I mean, they did bump him off, but they forced him out, and they brought in the man from Charlton Heston, a very despicable right-wing guy, who, by the way, had started off as a left-winger, as had Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan used to hang around the left. That's something the labor, everybody should reflect on. Many people start off with progressive reputations, and then they end up, like Hassan Youssef, in the Senate. And you say, how did that happen and why? I would suggest it is that at the rainbow, there's a pot of gold, and that might be one explanation. But in terms of how to maintain the struggle, we should study people like Asner. And I hope that people get his book. I hope people get the book Maker, by Jim Upton. I think we've basically covered the labor scene. I can say one additional thing on the, you raised Haymarket. People should make a trip like you're going to a holy spot. There is a cemetery, West Chicago. I visited several times, where there is a Haymarket Martyrs statue, and their names are there, and there are other, and there's a thing called, there's an area called the Left. What is it? No, it's called the Communist Plot. Emma Goldman is buried near them, nearby. You'll see the names of great figures in labor history. But that monument was a tremendous thing. And as you say, it sparked the movement that caused May Day. And I don't think we're even on the road to keep being free until we have a May Day in which the labor movement and everybody agrees that we'll take the day we don't work, like in Mexico, like in Spain, like in France. So we've been speaking to Tony Leah, labor scholar and labor activist. Tony, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back with a little bit more in a moment.